Welcome to the podcast. Today, we have Gervais Williams, award-winning fund manager at Mighton, who specializes in investing in small caps and micro caps. Thank you for coming on. It's great to have you today.
Hello there.
Just to start, how did you initially get involved in investing or becoming interested in small caps?
I mean, going back to, you know, my childhood, I was always interested in the share prices, what moved them, all that kind of stuff. I was initially trained up as an engineer, but once I became fully qualified, I really moved on to the financial world, which I was always interested in. And I moved into the small companies fund management group in 1985. I loved the sector. I've loved the sector ever since, and I'm still there.
Amazing. Why did you like the sector or investing in smaller companies specifically?
I mean, there's two reasons, really. I think the main reason is that when you invest in small companies, you get involved with companies which are agile. You get involved in companies which can make a difference. The deals particularly are quite large, often compared to the some underlying companies. And so just occasionally you can meet a company which does a transformational deal. Even companies which grow organically, which don't do deals, can actually grow to become very meaningful. So the opportunity really is to get involved in companies which make a difference. The second feature, of course, is that companies themselves are you know, on the stock market. And in that regard, if you do get successful, the valuations can move up quite considerably. And as they get larger, you find that more investors look at them and you get this kind of virtuous spiral where the very successful companies can make a multiple on your original investment.
In the small cap space, is there a guiding principle or a strategy that you employ when you look for smaller companies to invest in?
I don't think so, actually, in that I think, you know, you can get successful investments in big multinational companies just as much as you can in small microcap companies. So I don't think the principles are very different. But clearly, when you're investing in small companies, particularly if you're investing as an institutional investor with a number of clients, then you obviously find you may hold a significant part of the company. And that means that you take more liquidity risk. You can get in, you can get out, but it takes time in both cases. And so that, from that point of view, you are investing in companies which have a longer duration. You can't just change your mind tomorrow or next week. You really are working with the company on the long-term basis.
Would you say it's quite active investing when you participate in smaller companies because you sort of guide their overall process?
Yeah, I mean, I think active investing is about moving away from the consensual. You can do that in larger companies. You can do that in small companies. But really, what is really interesting is that you get engagement with companies, you get engaged with the management team, you can have an influence on what decisions they did make, the kinds of things which they drive towards. You can help them perhaps stay around some of the worst of the uncertainties in the future. And all of that helps ultimately to deliver a better return, but also to make the company more successful and really generate not just returns for investors, but also ongoing employment growth, extra tax take for the UK economy, and of course, domestic growth.
Do you find yourself affected by the changes in MiFID II, or do you not really find yourself affected by the changes to research and independent research on smaller cap companies?
So MiFID II is about unbundling the transaction charges, which are principally for accessing liquidity in the marketplace, but also in the past have also covered certain research, external research costs. Going forward, now because they're unbundled, the actual costs of transactions have come down a tiny bit, but most particularly, people are more careful about whether they should be paying for any of the external research. If anything, we've seen that the very smallest companies haven't really changed very much. That they've always had relatively few research notes, and those which have come out have typically been funded by the companies themselves because their broker, as part of their agreement, would issue some trading updates. The slightly small companies, but not quite as so small, maybe 200 million market cap, 300 million market cap type businesses, tend to find that there may be slightly fewer independent research notes on them. So there may be a fewer notes at the end of the day. At the end of the day, though, I'm not so sure that actually it hasn't also improved the visibility of certain analysts. And I think some analysts have picked up the ball and become a little bit more high profile in terms of the stocks which they're covering. And I think that may have helped as well. So I don't think it's all bad. I think it's been a mixed outcome.
Great. Did you feel like sort of a maverick when you started your small cap income fund?
Yeah, so when I joined Mighton, rather than set up just a small cap fund, which we'd been running at Gartmore, I specifically set up a multi-cap fund, investing in big and small, but specifically a heavy weighting in small and micro-cap companies, and with a big bias towards small companies' income. I think after 2008, we thought that the world would gradually change, and that income, and particularly income growth, would become much more important to investors. And therefore, the opportunity to invest not just in big companies, but also small companies, which sometimes generate income and sometimes can generate more income growth, was particularly exciting, especially given that most of the competitors in the sector, most of the professional investors in the small cap area, tend to look for growthy investments. So they tend to overlook many of the income stocks. So the opportunity set was very exciting. The valuations appeared to be ultra low compared with the prospects. And indeed, many of the companies have continued to go and generate good and growing income since that time. So it's been a lovely strategy to follow. It's generated some good income for our investors. But most particularly, we think that it's a strategy which is quite well set for the forthcoming world, which may be more uncertain.
Are you willing to share some of your best and possibly worst investments, but most importantly, the lessons that you learned from them?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Clearly, I've had quite a lot of stocks which have gone up a long way, and I'm sure I can remember a few of the names, but actually, the ones which I lose money on always live longer in my memory. So it is about learning from your mistakes. And one of the things about investing, particularly across a portfolio, is that you have to take a degree of risk. And when you take a degree of risk, that does involve a percentage of downside investments. So just because you've lost money doesn't actually mean that this original decision was wrong in the context of other decisions made at that time. I think the area where the sort of hardest lesson I've learned, the area where I've had the deepest sort of setback, I suppose, has been on financial stocks, particularly highly geared financial stocks. Mm. Those companies, when they go wrong fastest and most completely, the quickest from start to finish. So I have got quite a bit of scar tissue on highly geared financial stocks. That's definitely a big lesson we've learned. Going forward, I think, if anything, the last 30 years have been relatively benign for corporates. Interest rates have come down. We have had setbacks, 2008 and such like. But each time, it's usually ended up with interest rates coming down over the period. And that has meant that actually the penalty for having excessive debt has not been that severe, really, for the last 30 years. My own view is that has reached an end, and going forward, I think all investors, not just small cap investors, all investors are going to have to be a lot more attentive to balance sheet security, reducing holdings in those companies which are overlevered, and most particularly steering around companies which have risks where if they do have a minor setback, that they are then unable to continue dividends or indeed investing in their businesses and could need an emergency rights issue or indeed may risk going into liquidation.
Is there a particular industry or sector you're paying really close attention to now?
I think what's been interesting about the last 30 years, again, is that we've been in a period when the forces of globalization have shaped the largest companies in the UK. So if you look at the largest quoted companies in the FTSE 100, for example, they're dominated by a relatively narrow range of sectors. That would include banks and insurance companies and companies to do with the financial sector generally, such as property companies. Of course, on top of that, we've seen pharmaceuticals being very successful. Certain large commodity stocks, such as oil stocks, have had a very long period of growth. And so we've got a relatively narrow range of sectors which dominate the UK market. And when you look overseas, you find that globalization has also shaped the largest weightings perhaps in the European markets or indeed the US markets or the Japanese markets. And so you find actually that there's a monoculture of sectors in most of the mainstream indices. And therefore, we shouldn't be surprised by how they tend to move in sync with each other. The correlation of movements between the US market, for example, the Japanese market, European markets, UK market, is obvious to all. You just watch it overnight, you know. So from that point of view, I think one of the features going forward, which is going to be important for all investors, is to have a degree of sector diversification, not just stocks diversification, but sector diversification. And one of the thrilling things about the UK specifically is that we still have a vibrant universe of smaller micro-cap stocks. specifically, we have a vibrant universe of small and microcap stocks in a range of sectors which are not well represented in the main markets. And we think that's crazily interesting going forward, because it doesn't mean the share prices won't go down or that can't make poor investments. But specifically, ultimately, as we get this change coming through and some of the core sectors may be coming under pressure, you may find other sectors which aren't well represented in the main market, which actually are able to buck the trend or indeed grow even and thrive. At a time when perhaps the world's in a period of slow growth or recession. So we're really very, very upbeat about the opportunity to widen the sector spread in the portfolios, introduce a degree of lesser correlation, perhaps a degree of resilience, which we think is going to be crazily important going forward.
Do you think a lot of other institutional investors will recognize this, and particularly the UK equity market and funds will start flowing?
Yes, it is interesting. I mean, really, you know, since 88 or early 90s, we haven't really had significant institutional investments in small and microcap stocks. We've had investments in mid-sized companies and largest companies, but small and microcap stocks have really been a feature, a reducing feature of most institutional clients' portfolios. What's been interesting about the last two or three years isn't that that's changed enormously. It's got to a very low level, but specifically, there has been just a degree of interest. We have seen a number of new investment trusts which have been launched in the microcap area. We've seen a number of open-ended investment companies which have moved into microcaps as well. There has been some institutional allocation to these, not large in the context of their portfolios, but a step in the right direction. I think that's tremendously interesting in that it's a change in trend. As a trend, I think I expect to continue in spite of Brexit or any of the other challenges we might have in the short term.
Mm. Do you think post-Brexit, if it's all de-risked or in the eyes of institutions de-risked, we'll see more of that trend continuing?
Absolutely. What's been interesting about the market, say, since Brexit was first decided, was after the initial sort of 6 weeks of hiatus, small and microcap companies have outperformed progressively until recently. They've underperformed recently. And that was against, you know, rising interest rates, a slowdown in the consumer sector, a move to a minority government. All of these features might have been expected to put people off small companies. But actually, as I say, their inherent vibrancy, their ability to be more agile in terms of a period of change, and specifically because they have third-party capital access to markets, they can actually raise additional capital and take advantage of change and make a commercial return on that. So I think that's going to be a feature which is going to be a relevant feature, yes, over the period into Brexit, after the period of Brexit. And the UK, as I say, is an area where I think there are a sort of thriving infrastructure around these companies, which I just don't think you find in most other international markets.
Why do you think that is? The UK has this great diversification across sectors and countries like the US, for example. Or others.
I mean, certainly the US do have lots of small companies, but they tend to be much bigger small companies. It's a much bigger universe. Hmm. They do have pink sheets and certain sort of near quoted companies, which, you know, are quite interesting in themselves. But the UK is unusual in having this particular heritage towards smallness, which I think has been there for the last 50 or 100 years with the regional stock exchanges and such like. But also, more importantly, I think there has been a number of tax benefits which have kept the market open. So if you take the VCT benefits, for example, I think that's meant that capital pools have been raised, you know, each tax year, and that capital has been available to invest, say, over the following 3 years. And that's meant that even if you raise money in 2007, there was a warm pool of capital to be invested in small microcap companies in 2008 and 2009 when other markets were closed. And I think that was a very favorable factor which kept the market open. I think IHT has brought more interest into the sector more recently. We've seen specific fund wealth managers who probably participated in that market, and that's also been helpful keeping the market open. And even the EI scheme has meant that the stepladder for companies coming to market has been there, so that they've been able to build up a business which is large enough to become quoted. So I think all of these features in themselves have helped to keep the industry open at a time when institutional investment interest was at a low level.
And in your book, The Retreat of Globalization, you identified post-2008 as a defining moment in corporate behavior. Could you explain why?
Yes, I mean, I think what's been interesting about the last 30 years is that the pattern became very well established. And in that way, I think it meant that progressively institutional investors and, you know, and savers became to recognize that actually investing in mid and large cap companies could produce very, very good returns. Mm. At a time when the world's growing rapidly, you do find that actually larger companies can grow just as fast as smaller companies indeed. So you didn't really need smallness. On top of that, of course, you know, having the diversification into some of the emerging markets, which were growing rapidly at the time, the surge of low-cost imports, which meant that, of course, that interest rates never really went up much in the UK. We've had the advantage of low-cost labour access to the UK, and that meant that corporates were able to take advantage of that in terms of keeping their costs down. Interest rates, of course, came down in the UK as well. So this was a sort of favourable background when corporates grew well. Earnings growth was excellent. Profit margins across the developed world doubled from 1985. So it's been an incredible period when all corporates have had a great background. That's fine as long as it lasts. But nothing goes on without ever changing. And what's been interesting about the last 10 years since 2008 is that we got quantitative easing introduced, which was definitely required to save the banking sector and to re-liquefy the financial markets. But in doing so, we distorted market prices. That's how quantitative easing works. And because we distorted market prices, it meant that allocation wasn't so effective. And what's been unfortunate really about the last 10 years is that the adoption of quantitative easing again and again and again has left that distortion in place. And for many companies, that's meant that they haven't invested as much in CapEx as they might have done otherwise. They've probably skewed towards paying more dividends than they would have done otherwise. And this has led to corporates themselves, the cash flow within corporates, to decay because they haven't been investing as much as they had previously. So corporate cash flow is not as buoyant as it used to be. And that has now led to wage growth being constrained. And that's, you know, after 10 years led to a real unhappiness with the current political choices and, of course, a change in the political agenda. And as the electorate have had their say in terms of Brexit or perhaps Trump or the far right in Sweden or Germany, we are seeing a very different pattern in terms of the political agenda, but also the economic policies going forward. So economic policies are changing more now than they've changed for the last 30 years. That means that many of the status quo companies will find that their models challenged. Perhaps new companies will come in. I am very anxious that actually some companies have become over indebted in the period and are more vulnerable to going bust. Clearly, we've seen Carillion earlier this year, and there may be others like that, which unfortunately get caught out. And that will be very disruptive. It leads to social distress. It's a difficult time, but ultimately we've got to find our way forward. And one of the ways forward is to make sure that we are more effective at allocating capital in future as QE has come to an end. And specifically, we generate not just good returns, but actually cash which can be reinvested into improving corporate returns over the long term, which so we can pay wage rises going forward. And that's absolutely, you know, the whole point about the financial world, it is socially useful. We hardly ever talk about this, but the whole point about allocation is that it makes it better for people who are saving for their pensions, but also it generates employment. It generates domestic growth. It generates companies which pay corporate tax, which is then used for health service and other things. So we've kind of lost sight of that a little bit over the last 10 years with the adoption of QE. Now that's phasing out. I think we're in a period of readjustment. It may be painful. Markets are unsettled. But as I say, I think the opportunity for an allocating towards small companies, as well as international assets and larger companies, etc., I think is going to be a feature which is going to be one of the factors which allows the UK economy to thrive in the future.
Has it been hard this year, given all the political, global factors influencing the markets, for you allocating money to small cap companies?
Not especially. I mean, it's not easy when the market's going down. Mm. The key issue is that we believe that as investors, the area where we have the greatest opportunity of making good decisions is on meeting companies and allocating to individual risk and reward characteristics. Clearly, you've got to do that in the context of what's happening in the international world, political change, potential interest rate rises, and all the other features which might be relevant. But as I say, coming back to the main role, the role is meeting companies and allocating on the basis of those individual meetings. And we believe that if we're disciplined in this way, that we can generate an attractive return over the long term. Clearly, we're not immune to market moves. And if share prices move down, then many of the share prices in which we invest will also move down. But as I say, over the sort of longer term, you'll find that the fundamentals will come through. And going back to the 1970s and the 1980s, what was interesting was at a time when the UK had recessions and UK economy is growing less fast than Europe, and you know, we had certain governments which were less business friendly, and indeed, you know, sterling itself, the exchange rate was weak. Small companies outperformed. They outperformed progressively. They generated better returns. They generated better dividend growth. My own view is that we're entering a period when that's going to be repeated.
And you mentioned liquidity earlier. Do you see changes happening in liquidity in the markets in the near future?
Liquidity is crazily important. It's not just about setting a price and allowing companies to raise capital at a fair value. It's also really about making sure that, that there's a good mix of different types of investors in your company. So even in small companies, you don't just have institutional investors. You have a lot of private investors. There's quite a lot of private investors who actually focus on small companies, and that's a tremendously positive thing. We have quite a lot of investors who are just buying across the figures, sort of day trader type investors. We've got quite a lot of investors who are families who have a major holding in their company, and they've had that for many, many decades. So there's just this great range of different investors with different time periods and different investment strategies. And it's those differences which then allow the market makers to set the prices and keep liquidity open. And the UK market has still got relatively good liquidity. I think that's a really fantastic way of obviously allowing companies to raise external capital, but also it's a fantastic way of allowing companies to see the success coming through in terms of their share prices and for their staff and their customers and things to recognize that they, you know, some companies aren't just successful but are in a position to really make a big, you know, to invest on the back of their success to scale up that success.
And do you see the rise in popularity of tracker funds or exchange traded funds having an impact on liquidity in the future if this trend continues?
I mean, it's always worry it when you get a particular group of investors which tend to be investing with the same kind of mindset. I don't know to what degree trackers and exchange traded funds have a common agenda when they to the investors who are buying those funds, but most of them seem to have a similar investment strategy. And there's a danger, therefore, that you find that you get tremendous flows into some of these products. Certainly over the last 10 years, exchange-traded funds have been very successful. Index funds have been very successful in attracting inflows. And I do worry that if, for whatever reason, you get a synchronized outflow of investors or withdrawal of capital, that could lead to certain share prices becoming very distorted and illiquidity to be a feature. So that's certainly an issue. Of course, at the smaller quota companies end of the market, if you look at smaller microcap particularly, they're nothing to do with ETFs. Exchange traded funds don't invest in small quota companies, they're illiquid. So actually, it's not a future at this end of the market. And I think that's something perhaps which may be a feature which actually is advantageous over the long term.
What else are you worried about in the near future? Productivity growth?
Productivity growth is a key one. As I say, it's the cornerstone of an investment return. Collecting together of our savings and allocating them to individual companies, which are able to put that capital to work and generate a stream of cash payback, which is worth more than original capital, is based upon productivity. Productivity through investment is the way forward. And unfortunately, without much productivity, not so much in the UK, but around the world for the last 10 years, that engine isn't working very well. And although investment returns in nominal terms look pretty good and stock markets gone up and such the last 10 years, I do worry whether the underlying vitality of the corporate sector has somewhat decayed over the last 10 years. And I think, therefore, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the risk that companies going bust and newer companies growing through will be part of the resetting of that. But it is a pretty uncomfortable process to get there. So from my point of view, looking at this, productivity is the cornerstone. It's the key measure going forward. Because by generating productivity improvement, we generate a surplus, which can then be used for those who are more vulnerable in our society, you know, those who aren't well, those who are young, those who are aged. All of that is absolutely the good operation of a capital market.
And is there anything you're really excited about in the near future?
Yes. I mean, I get excited about individual companies all the time. It's a wonderful thing. You know, we do have, you know, it's easy for us to knock the UK economy, and it's not that, you know, it's not that exciting compared to many other economies. It's had a period of slowing growth. It may move into recession in due course. It's all too easy to sort of get excited about things going on in other places, some of the big tech stocks in the US and stuff. Mm. But what is exciting, regularly exciting, is the quality of some of our management teams, their motivation and what they're trying to achieve, their willingness to spend years in these roles, often without much profile, sometimes with quite a lot of sort of adverse comment along the way from the press and things. But ultimately, you know, we are really unusual in the UK in having a vibrant universe of small and micro-cap companies. And many of the companies I meet, I get very excited about. And that's always been a pleasure in the job, but it's something which I think doesn't get much profile.
What do you see for the future of the UK economy, given the rise of Asia and other emerging economies? And do you see that the current crises in, for example, Argentina or Turkey, are you affected by that or excited by the opportunities they provide at all? Or does it not really affect your...
Yes, I mean, what's interesting really, what we've seen with quantitative easing for the last 10 years is a warm background to all marginal borrowers largely, and that includes countries and companies. So many of these marginal economies which are reliant on overseas debt have had a relatively good run. As quantitative easing has been phased out, as quantitative tightening has been introduced in the US, we're now in a period where that warm background of liquidity has been reduced somewhat, and that therefore marginal borrowers are finding it harder. Yes, Turkey, yes, Argentina, yes, certain Asian economies as well. I don't think that's going to go away. There may be more QE used at times of financial distress, but generally it distorts market prices. And I think central banks have come to the conclusion that one of the reasons that productivity hasn't improved or has been held back is by the operation of quantitative easing. So whilst it may be used on occasions going forward, I don't think it'll be used in the same kind of way we've seen for the last 10 years. So I think we've got to get used to less liquidity. I think it's going to be tougher for marginal borrowers, certain economies. I think it'd be tougher for certain companies which are marginal borrowers as well. I think there's more companies going bust. Where's the UK in that round? I mean, the UK is actually slightly dependent on overseas borrowing, so we're not like Argentina, but we're not entirely different either. And one of the features I think we'll have to be in the UK is become more productive in terms of generating cash and profits here rather than just relying on our investments overseas. And I think that will lead to a rebalancing of the UK economy. I think manufacturing, for example, will probably be a bigger part of our economy in 15 years' time than it is at the moment. So I think there's going to be changes coming through. One of the good things about the UK, though, is that we've always been relatively adaptable. We do have a long heritage of allocation of capital across different companies. And if that continues going forward, I think it's absolutely going to set the UK on a different pattern to most other developed markets. And indeed, it may be that we start to find that certain international stocks start to list on our AIM market or indeed the NEX market. And we find that actually the use of those capital markets isn't just dominated by the UK quoted companies, but actually by certain Israeli companies already come to the UK market. We've seen the odd US company, certainly some Australian and some Canadian companies. If that pattern persists, we could become one of the major exchanges for international small microcap companies. I think that would be tremendously good, partly because it would make it easier for our UK quoted companies to get access to capital, but also because I think the features of this sector will be equally good news for many of our international competitors. So for that reason, I am very upbeat, actually, about the scope for us and the UK to find a way forward beyond globalization.
Right. And you spend, obviously, most of your day juggling between looking at larger structural factors or macroeconomic factors and also looking at individual companies. What do you think is the most enjoyable part about working in this industry or your particular role?
Yes, I mean, the sort of background, the economic weather, as I called it, is tremendously relevant when making individual decisions. You can't look at an individual company in isolation. You do need to look at it in the context of the economic trends behind it. So both factors are relevant. I do spend quite a bit of time trying to assess where I think the biggest risks are on the economic side of things to help steer around the worst of the problems up ahead. But actually, of course, you know, none of us know. So at the end of the day, it's all about investing across a range of different companies, across a range of different sectors, and most particularly having a range of less correlated or uncorrelated risks across portfolios. And that does mean that, as I said earlier, that sometimes you do hold companies which don't turn out to be successful in terms of returns. But in the context of other parts of the portfolio, because the risks aren't correlated in those companies which get caught out, there are many others in the portfolio which are not just surviving but thriving. It means the overall returns are more attractive, and particularly the volatility of those returns is often smoother than you might imagine. Small quoted companies as a group tend to be a smoother ride than large cap quoted companies as a group. And that's down to the wider sector representation, the often the more conservative balance sheets, and the ability of companies, when they get it wrong, to be agile enough to find a way forward in spite of. So all of that features are the dominant part of my day, meeting companies. I meet those companies. It's a pleasure to meet companies. And those are very productive meetings, not just in terms of helping my understanding of the risk reward of individual companies, but also hopefully, you know, for them, giving some feedback on the areas which might be of risk to them and some of the economic features which we're worried about going forward.
And what do you think about certain funds who take a different approach and have a very concentrated portfolio? Yes, diversified across industries and sectors, but maybe only hold between 20 and 25 stocks.
I mean, it's horses for courses. I mean, you know, there's many ways of skinning a cat. And that's a good thing. So I think that diversity in terms of stock selection, diversity in terms of portfolio construction, I think is fantastic. And you know, I hope that they are successful in a strategy. It may be a bit more volatile. The returns may be better. They may be suit certain clients better. You know, others have strategies which are more growthy or value based. Others concentrate on dividends. You know, it's good to have a melange of all sorts of different perspectives, which allow certain companies to get supported by a range of investors where that particular company you know, has a good profile. So it's not that we all crowd into growth stocks because growth stocks are performing strongly. It's actually that we've got those perspectives and that companies have access to capital, even for some companies which aren't growing very much, or new companies which have come to market, or companies which have disappointed in the past, but where they've got a good chance of actually turning it around and recovering strongly. So it you know, I'm very comfortable.
And is generally positive for efficient capital markets and good for liquidity. But the more
exactly that. I mean, as I say, I think when it comes to liquidity, having investors with different perspectives and different timeframes and different selection processes is absolutely great, and it maximizes liquidity, allows prices to be set on a regular basis, and therefore access to capital for these companies should they want to invest a more substantial sum in a bigger project.
In your book, one of your books, I read, you have a focus, or you write about a focus on investing locally and how, yes, globalization is good, but investors and everyday people should also pay attention to investing locally, sometimes for the benefit of your local economy. Do you still believe that?
Yeah, so that was when I wrote Slow Finance, which was, I think, published in 2011. Mm. One of the features of that book was to compare the understanding of the knowledge of the ingredients in your portfolio rather than just looking at the strategy, have greater appreciation of the underlying ingredients. And of course, if you're investing in quoted companies, many of those quoted companies could be local to you. And as a local individual, you would probably have some insights which aren't that obvious from the stock market in London. So I think there's a real opportunity for individual investors to bring those insights when they're looking at their portfolios, either to select companies themselves or to monitor the portfolios which are managed on their behalf. And the side benefits are that you find that you are more able to bring your own thoughts to it. You can talk to your friends about the company. You can talk to the employees of the company. You might even occasionally at public meetings and stuff bring insights of your own experience to the management team of that company. And all of those things are very important. I mean, the history is that the UK used to have a lot of regional stockbroking, stock markets. And, you know, that's inefficient in terms of liquidity in certain ways. And it's, you know, and then bringing everything together maximizes liquidity and access to liquidity, which is good. But on the other hand, perhaps it's a shame that we've lost some of those links between the local population and the companies which are successful in the area and which don't just generate investment returns, but also, as I say, generate employment, they generate tax take, they generate domestic growth. And I think that's a feature which is going to become more important. I think when people buy index funds, for example, sometimes they don't spend a lot of time looking at the underlying ingredients. People assume that it's a nice diversified range of stocks with nice diversified range of risks. And I just don't think that's the case, actually. I think if you look at some of the largest mainstream indices, they're dominated by one or two stocks. You can have very large weightings. And if those companies were to get tripped up or caught out, you'd find that they would end up potentially leading to quite substantial setbacks for those investors in terms of permanent loss of capital. And on top of that, you find that many of the companies are operating in sectors which are duplicated by other companies in the same index. So you find these index weightings are very, very large in certain cases. And as I say, I think that aggregated risk hasn't really been a big feature for the last 30 years. You know, the downside of getting caught out by risk is not been too painful. Not many companies have gone bust. Not many sectors have had a really bad setback. You know, clearly there have been some. Banking in 2008 was a good example of one which did have a proper setback and lost permanent capital, but most haven't. And therefore, I think the sensitivity of investors to downside risk and the risk of loss of capital is probably been sort of slightly come into a position where it's probably a little bit complacent. And I think really going forward, I think investors need to be more attentive to this, because I do fear that the downside risk on some of these features will become a lot more significant and people will wake up to it, but I don't want them to wake up to it too late.
When you wake up in the morning and you get into work, what resources do you consider before you start your day? Or are you continuously consulting different resources like macro research or specific company notes? Or does it change on a daily basis?
No, I mean, investment background, you know, it does change, but it changes slowly. You know, I mean, I'm interested in what's happening internationally, whether the market's gone up or down. I'm kind of very interested as well in certain currencies. You know, I'm anxious that the Chinese economy may slow. It may be that when it does slow, that world growth is much slower than it has been. China has probably added about half of the world growth since 2008, and were it to have a slow period of growth or recession, that would obviously make a big difference to the world growth going forward. And I keep an eye on that specifically, and one of the ways I keep an eye on that is on the Chinese exchange rate. So the Chinese exchange rate's been relatively stable the last few weeks, but there have been periods when it's been quite weak. And if it is quite weak, I do fear that that would be a feature which would export a degree of deflation to the rest of the world. You know, they are a very large economy. They are an economy very dominant in the manufacturing area. And so if they did find that, for whatever reason, currency was entering a long period of weakness, then their prices would come down, and that may undermine the profitability of certain of our local companies. So that's probably something which I'm probably keeping an eye on closer than most other things at the moment.
And when you do keep an eye on China, for example, or other global factors, are you considering things like demographics, and are you going in depth, or are you just keeping an eye on it?
Yeah, I mean, demographics are a key feature which make a big difference long term. One of the features of the world generally is that we've got an aging population. That's particularly true of the developed markets. It's not so true in some of the developing markets, although strange enough, it is true in China for their own reasons. Mm-hmm. But that is a feature which, you know, how you sustain older people, a larger population of older people, is a key challenge for all of the economies of the world, but it's particularly true of many of the developed markets in China. So that will be a feature which sort of undermines the opportunity for productivity improvement. That said, you know, there are plenty of economies, even in Europe, which are very favourable in demographics. Ireland has been probably at the favourable end. It's becoming a bit more normal now, but it's been very favourable up to now. Iceland is in a superb position at the moment in terms of demographics. So even places relatively close to home do have very favourable demographics. And on that basis, we should be interested in keeping alive to some of the investment prospects in some of these territories as well.
Are you thinking about or working on a book at the moment, or considering?
No, I'm not actually. A bizarre thing, I never intended to write a single book actually. That's not been part of the grand plan. But when I did leave Gartmore, I was involved in putting funding together to save what was Man Funds and put it in a strong financial position before I joined Mighton. And I still had about 8 weeks before I joined. And so I did write to Bloomsbury and Penguin and just said, if they wanted a book on slow finance, I was happy to write it. And amazingly, Bloomsbury came back and said, yes, that'd be fine. And so I wrote it over the following 8 weeks.
Amazing.
So that was just sort of, interesting.
Yeah.
More recently, with The Future is Small, I was approached by a publisher to talk about the AIM market, and I think it's quite an interesting subject, and given that I felt that small companies were probably entering a period of cyclical outperformance, I thought it was quite an interesting time. So I did write that book. It's not a very long book, 25,000-30,000 words, but I do find it quite interesting writing books, because the whole process of setting down on paper what you think, rereading it and finding that it's not quite exactly what you meant, and adjusting it helps me get a better understanding of what my true positions are, and then checking the facts, which you always have to do, of course, and finding that some of them I've misremembered, and then looking at my arguments in the context of that. I think that whole process is really brilliantly helpful at a time when world is change is coming through, and this is a period when I think more change is coming through than the most, and that's really where the Retreat for Globalization came from. I wasn't writing a book. Mm-hmm. I was definitely writing stuff to get a good insight in my own view as to what the future might look like. And then, as it happened, I found that I had 20,000 or 30,000 words, well, near 30,000 words. And so I just approached the publisher and just said, would you mind? And they did, and they published it. I can't imagine my writing another book, but I would have said that 10 years ago before I wrote a single book. So who's to say?
3 books later.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you perhaps not a book, but are you working on putting together, consolidating your research and your writing on a particular topic at the moment? Because Retreat of Globalization was
2 years ago.
Yeah.
End of 2016. No, I've got nothing on that place. I mean, I keep writing small articles and stuff, which is good stuff. But I don't, I haven't got anything specific on that. I mean, I'm always writing stuff in that I always need to understand and check. But no, I haven't got any specifics on that.
Have you read or heard of the book by Ray Dalio, Debt?
I haven't read it. I've heard about it. I think debt is about the single most significant risk we have going forward. You know, when you do find yourself caught out with a bit too much debt, you know, raising emergency capital, particularly at a time of market setback, is very costly and dilutive to existing investors. It often leads to dividend cuts and potential receivership. You know, I regard debt as fairly toxic at the moment. And so we are doing all we can to minimize that risk on behalf of our clients.
And he draws a lot of similarities to the debt situation today and the situation in the 1930s and the rise of populism as we have today. Do you think history repeats itself, or do you think a large part of that is debt causing the rise of these issues, or is it just a contributing factor?
Yes, and the nature of debt is it accelerates growth. So it brings forward growth. You borrow it from the future, effectively. And so when it comes to taking on less debt, or indeed repaying some of the back debt which you've taken out previously, effectively you dilute growth and make it harder for people to make ends meet. What's been interesting about the last 30 years is that labour as a factor of production has been reducing for the last 30 years. I don't think that's going to carry on. I think labour as a factor of production will be an increasing trend. I think there will be a risk of more militancy. I think people will find it hard to make ends meet. I think corporate profit margins will come under pressure. But good leadership, access to external capital, buying assets from the receiver, if that's the case, to breathe new light into them is kind of important, because those individuals then can then find that they've got involved in an employer who is generating profit, who is able to invest in their business, who is able to develop new products and expand their product range. So from that point of view, you know, we've got to go through that. And I think financial markets have a really big part to play in that. But it is, as I say, a very uncomfortable process. And I'm assuming that we're sort of entering that period at the moment.
Well, Gervais, thank you very much for spending time with me and having a chat.
Thanks for that. I've got to run off to my next meeting.
Sure, no worries.
But thank you very much, Abraham. Really a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for including us in the podcast. As I say, you know, what has it taken? An hour of my time. And it's a pleasure to talk. And there's so much to talk about.
Gervais, thank you very much. It was a pleasure for me as well.